My name is Edward Burns. I'm the Senior Associate Dean at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Before I introduce Dr. Rosner, I just want to put in a little pitch for Albert Einstein. I was speaking to some of the pre-meds, at least the pre-med men in the audience today, and some of them said that they'll be applying to Harvard and Yale. I would suggest that they don't settle and trade down. At Albert Einstein, which is an institution that has notable alumni, namely Dr. Rosner, namely Dr. Steinberg, namely Dr. Reichman, there's a unique opportunity to really combine Torah Umada, to really pursue the concept of medical ethics, Jewish medical ethics, and halachic medical ethics through our various societies. I don't think I have to convince the women from Stern to come to Einstein because they have their own incentives. But for the men, as I say, don't trade down. Come to Einstein. Today, all of our discussions have been on the cutting edge. And it turns out that when we talk about Jewish medical ethics, there is a history. It all did not begin today. In 1959, the first English text on Jewish medical ethics was published by Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz, who at the time was the chief rabbi of Great Britain. And that was a condensation of his 1955 PhD thesis. But medicine in 1955, to be honest, had surgery, anesthesia, blood transfusions, and antibiotics. It was not very cutting edge. So most of the material in Jewish medical ethics talks about a Kohen going to medical school, the right to heal, etc., was really not the type of cutting-edge material that we've been hearing today. In 1972, the very first text on Jewish medical ethics that encompassed all of these modern things, such as abortion, contraception, organ transplant, it was right after Christian Barnard's heart transplants, was published by our next speaker, Dr. Fred Rosner. It was called Modern Medicine and Jewish Law, and it encompassed many of the articles that he and Rabbi Tendler had published in Tradition and Judaism and a number of other very important publications at the time. Since then, Dr. Rosner has continued to be a prolific publisher as a chief of medicine and published many books on medical ethics. And within the halls of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, we have pictures of what we call our most distinguished alumni. Unfortunately, to date, it seems to be restricted only to people in medical research, so people who invented the MRI, people who became heads of NIH, etc. They're the people that grace the hall. But in my heart, one of the most distinguished alumni of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine for his work in Jewish medical ethics is Dr. Fred Rosner.
Thank you very much, Dr. Burns. That was a very lavish introduction. As I say, I'm just sorry that my parents were not here to hear that. My father would have been proud and my mother would have believed it all. My job is really to give you a brief introduction to the topic of brain death in order to introduce the one of the world's experts on the subject, Rabbi Tendler, who you will hear from very shortly. Now, for thousands of years, doctors were able to diagnose death by examining the patient and finding no pulse, no breathing, and they declared him dead. And that's, in fact, the way Black's Law Dictionary defines death. But this definition was inadequate in 1968 when heart transplants began. And so the brain death definition was created and first enacted into law in the state of California, and now it's sort of accepted worldwide, at least in the Western world. And that brain death legislation uses language like irreversible cessation of all functions, brainstem functions, and the brainstem, as you know, controls the breathing and the heart. Now, for the students of the Daf Yomi, the daily page of Talmud, including myself, just a couple of weeks ago, we completed the tractate called Yuma, which deals with Yom HaKippurim. And the key source, the main source for all the controversy over the definition of death is found there on Daf Pei Gimel in the Mishnah and then Pei He in the Gemara. And the discussion and the controversy is all around a key Rashi there, a key Rashi. There was the Gemara, the story is really about a building that collapsed on the Sabbath. And you don't know if somebody's in there or if they're not in there. You don't know if he's dead or alive. You don't know if he's a Jew, if he's a non-Jew. Whatever it is, you must bring pickaxes and bulldozers, whatever it is, on the Sabbath or on Yom Kippur to push away all the rubble and to dig out whoever's there. And then it says, Motso Chai, if you find him alive, then you continue digging and you rush him off to the hospital. Even if he can only live for another 5 minutes, you've noticed he's critically ill. But still, Chaye Shor is worthwhile. Even a few moments of life is worthwhile, as I spoke about when I talked about euthanasia. So, V'im Motzori Meis, V'im Meis, if he's dead, however, then you manichnoi. So then you have to leave him there and come back after Shabbos and after Yom Kippur and then dig him out and make funeral arrangements. Then the Gemara asks, how do you determine? What do you mean? You said Motso Chai, you found him Chai. Ad Heichen, how far do you have to dig in order to determine whether the man's alive or dead, or woman, or child, whatever it is? So the Gemara says, Ad Chotmo, up to the nose. In other words, respiration. Rashi there says that you put a feather under the nose, and if there's no respiration, then the person is dead, obviously, because your respiration in those days was considered to be controlled by the heart. The heart pumped pneuma, or air, into the lungs, and therefore respiration and heartbeat was all controlled by pneuma. And if you have no breathing, then the person's dead. V'yesh omrim. Then the Gemara says, and there is another opinion that says, ad libo, that you have to examine up to the heart. You have to keep digging until you reach the heart. And we'll see what that means in a minute. And the Yerushalmi says, ad tiburo, up to his belly button. So it all depends whether you find him head first or feet first and so on. So the Yerushalmi, which says ad tiburo, it means if you're digging and you find him feet first, then you can go up to the belly button and you can see abdominal respirations. And if there's no abdominal respirations, that's the equivalent of putting the feather under the nose and there's no breathing, so the person's dead. Whereas the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, says either you got to go up to the nose, as I just described, or you have to go including the heart. V'yesh omrim, that's second opinion. And now, Rashi there says, Motzer, if you found him, and he's doimem ke'evan, he appears like a stone, not moving, nothing's moving. V'ein zozin nevorav, none of his organs are moving. You know, he's like an inanimate stone there. V'ein zozin nevorav, then he's dead. And as I mentioned, it depends on whether you find him feet first or head first as to whether you go to Tiburo, or at least that's how we reconcile the Bavli with the Yerushalmi. Okay. Now, there are lots of other sources for brain death, but this is the main one about which, this Rashi people argue about. What does it mean, the angels, none of his limbs are moving? But if the heart is still moving, if the heart is still beating, then he's not dead. And that's an argument which we will try and debunk. Now, Rabbi Tendler is many things, but one is he is the author of a brand new phrase which had never been used before called physiological decapitation. In other words, when Marie Antoinette was beheaded, obviously she was dead as soon as her head came off. Right? Her limbs may still be jumping around a little bit. That's reflex. That's nothing. That's just reflex action. That's pirchus. So the same thing is, if you can prove, as Rabbi Schechter said, that there is no circulation going to the brain at all, no blood going to the brain, and we can do this, and this isn't one of Rabbi Feinstein's tshuvas, that you can inject a radioactive material into the patient's arm and then put a Geiger counter over the head, and if there is no click, 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 no radiation, radioactive, then the patient has no circulation to the brain, all the blood vessels go into the brain, and therefore that brain is dead. And that's a vital organ, as you heard Rabbi Schechter say, and therefore that person is brain dead, at least brain dead. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, patient who's brain dead, you can remove him from the respirator. Okay, so this concept of physiologic decapitation is very, very important. And as I say, it was coined by Rabbi Tendler and has now been being used by all those who accept the brain death definition, which includes the Israeli chief rabbinate, which includes Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Feinstein. This is Rabbi Feinstein's position, and many other doctors and famous rabbis. On the other hand, there is another side which does not accept this, all based mainly on this Rashi, which says that he's not moving any limb. He's like a stone, an inanimate object. So, but if he is moving his heart, you know, then he's not dead. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zecheinu Tzadik Livracha, was brain dead for 6 weeks. And he was in Beth Israel Hospital, and they cleaned out a whole floor and made an ICU just for him. And then after 6 weeks, you know, he developed cardiorespiratory arrest, and they buried him. In fact, today is the Yahrzeit of the Baal Shem Tov and the very first Lubavitcher Rebbe, both today, Yud Ches Elul. What? Birthday, excuse me, birthday. Baal Shem Tov and the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. There are other questions, ethical questions and halachic questions that come up with a situation like that. In other words, number one, who's going to pay for the care of a brain dead patient? You know, the insurance is not going to cover it. The insurance says, patient's dead, we're not paying anymore. And also, even more important, is the fact that the Rebbe is occupying an ICU bed. Is that depriving another patient of that ICU bed? And what do we do with that? Is that halachically wrong? Is that medically wrong, certainly? Or is it legally wrong in American law, in Dina de Malchus Adina? Anyway, there are many other sources that I'm not going to talk about. If somebody is maguyed, somebody is guillotined, and his spinal cord is split through half and so on, and he's, you know, close to death, is he's metame, you know, and if he's metame, then he's like dead, you know, if he can transmit ritual defilement and so on. And then there are other sources which Rabbi Tendler may choose to quote. Let me now introduce my teacher, my mentor, my colleague, my friend, my posek, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who is really known worldwide for his not only his involvement in medical halacha and his psak, which follow psakas, which follow in the footsteps of his revered late father-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. But he is also a pulpit rabbi in the community synagogue in Muncie. He is a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University and gives shiurim there. He is the chairman of the biology department at Yeshiva University and is a microbiologist and many years ago discovered a chemical compound called refuin meaning it should heal, which was an anti-cancer drug, and that got a lot of attention at the time. And so he is really a multifaceted individual, and it is my privilege and pleasure to introduce to you Rabbi Moshe Tendler.
In about a half hour, I'll try to summarize what Fred just told you. if you'll notice, the logo up here is tilted to the right. That's where Yeshiva is going. But let me tell you what it means to tilt to the right. Tilt to the right means you're prepared to accept stringencies in halacha. There's a fabulous comment in the Shloha Kodosh. I prepared it. I teach this year the Smicha program, Yoredeya, Laws of Kashrus. The Shloha says as follows. When someone has a shaila, has a question, and he sees it two ways, a lenient or stringent approach, there's a posuk, Yigia kapecha kisochal ashrecha betovloch. Yigia kapecha means you work hard, then you'll be rewarded, ashrecha betovloch, it'll be good for you. Yigia kapecha kisochal, when you work hard at a shaila and decide it's kosher. But there are opinions that say it's not so kosher. Then you try harder until you convince yourself it's kosher. And then you eat it yourself. Kisochal, you should eat it. Then ashrecha betovloch, because you've affirmed the validity of halacha. A cop out. I am not sure. It's a suffix. Let's be machmir. I have a cap that someone sent me, a classic Munsi cap. It's sold by Tuvia in Munsi's. It says, I have a chumri you never heard of. I'm sorry that Rav Shechter is not here. As you might not know, I've had the schus of having Rav Shechter as a Talmid when I taught in the high school. We remained close friends, and my joy to see Rav Shechter become the Godol HaTorah that he is, really the Bria HaTichon, the major pillar supporting Harbotzas Torah education in our yeshiva. I believe that this topic, which is on the interface of halacha and the cutting edge of medicine, is so complex that not everyone should be involved in this topic. It's a topic that requires an answer to the question, how many brain-dead individuals did you see? How many times were you with an intensivist and tried to explain to you why this man is in deep coma and this man is brain dead? And how many times have you been with families, with children who are declared brain dead, and the mother asks, but it's no different than it was yesterday. What's happened? Why is he dead today? Yesterday he was lying still also. The answer to these questions required my father-in-law, Zatzal, 2 years in which every department head of Albert Einstein came to the house, and head of transplant kidney was with him for 2 nights, slept in his house, and then it took him 2 years to decide that brain dead is dead, not because of organ transplant. For the key question that was posed to him by myself concerned our local hospital, when can you take a man off the ventilator? Not the mitzvah of saving another life. And here is easy to answer, don't take him off, leave him there. But the question was, if he's dead, you have a mitzvah to bury him. If he's dead, a kohen shouldn't walk in. If he's dead, his wife is almona. This is the issue at hand, when organ donation became a possibility, that added just another aspect, maybe a pressure point. I don't want you to answer me. I do not know how to answer this question. Nor can you answer, well, I can take an organ, but cannot give an organ. And when someone asked in the audience, but, it's a chilul Hashem, you're desecrating God's name. You are holding up the Jew to ridicule and to criticism. Mishum Eva, for fear of the hatred of the non-Jew, we allow a doctor to be Machal Shabbos to save a non-Jew's life. We can't just let that go away with a shrug. It needs an answer. And the answer is, if you can't give an organ, you can't take an organ. But Baruch Hashem, from a brain-dead patient, you're permitted to give organs, or rather, you're obligated to give organs, not a mitzvah, as Rav Willig referred to, but a chiyuv, because Rav Willig was talking about live donor. There it's a mitzvah, not a chiyuv. When I'm talking about a dead donor, then it's a chiyuv, not a mitzvah. Can I have the next slides? That's just my abstract, following a normal practice of publishing. I submitted an abstract. Go ahead. Okay. This is the halachic basis of medical care. There are three psukim. V'rapo yirape, that's a negation of faith healing. That says, yeah, the Ribono Shel Olam is the real doctor, but if you don't go to a fake doctor, the real doctor won't function either. You go to a fellow who thinks he's a doctor. Why does he think he's a doctor? He took pre-med, he went to medical school, residency, fellowship, so he thinks he's a doctor. That's how I set up my world. If you go to that doctor, then I may help you. You don't go to that doctor, I won't help you either. If you go to the doctor and think that he can help you, I won't help you either. That's what the Rabban says. Nitnu reshus l'rofei l'rapos, ronitnu reshus l'chola l'hitrapot. A doctor has a permission to heal, but a patient has no permission to be healed. What does that mean? I mean, the doctor has to think, I can heal. And the patient has to know he can't without the help of the Ribono Shel Olam. The second pasuk is already referred to by Rav Shachter, a mitzvah, a personal obligation. Vashevosalo, you should return it to him. You have to return his health. But if I don't know how, I'm not a doctor. How can I return his health? Then you go to the next pasuk, Lo samar adam reyecho. Then hire a doctor to help him. It's your obligation to incur the expense to heal someone else. This is the basis for national health service, for national health insurance. You don't have to drive the same car I drive, but you have to have the same health care I have. That's a mitzvah in the Torah. And Osama Adam Reyecha is a special mitzvah on those who have the authority. If someone who has the samchut, the authority, has the achayut, has the responsibility to fulfill this mitzvah. Here, I present to you an intriguing personality insight. Insight in the personality of my great father-in-law, Zatzal. Rav Weiss Zatzal, when he was Rav in Manchester, then became the head of the Bedatz in Yerushalayim, posed the question about organ donation, then kidney donation from deceased patient, and wrote to my father-in-law reasons why he feels it's forbidden. Oh, there, if you can see it, he quotes somebody, and the Shvel says, nonsense. There's no such halacha. And then Rav Weiss posed the question, but after all, the family suffers greatly at the thought of mutilating a loved one. A loved one that could open the belly, take out the kidneys. Right? It's great tsar, great pain. So my father-in-law answers, you're quite right. That you're supposed to give all the money, not to violate a biblical commandment, a negative commandment. Since it says, Lo sam al adam re'echo, you must pay money, but you don't have to suffer. That's not required. Suffering isn't required by halacha. We suffer only in two mitzvahs, milah, circumcision, and Yom Kippur. Otherwise, there's no suffering. Therefore, if you say the family is suffering at the thought, it's psychological suffering, mind you, not physiological suffering, then you're exempt from approving the organ donation. Then he concludes, classic emotion. Right. But don't you realize that you're saving a human life and therefore you shouldn't be suffering? The mitzvah is not to suffer and to save a life. This is not
chiyuv.
This is not mitzvah.
You see the language up there? L'chayiv.
This is chiyuv, an obligation. You must do so. Next. So you know what we're talking about. We are talking about injury over here. And that injury occurred by many ways, as we'll see. The key is that area of the brain, the medulla, which controls breathing, is not functioning. Therefore, the person cannot breathe. Now, what does it mean, he cannot breathe? A fellow can have an asthmatic attack and cannot breathe. A fellow can have a polio attack and he cannot breathe, but he can father children and he can publish books. Next slide. This is the universal definition of death. This is accepted by every country in the world, by every hospital in the world. There is no dispute. Irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem. That's neurological death. Now, the only machlokes, the only controversy that's now raging is the doctors are yelling, why the entire brain? Why not just the cerebrum? Why not just the part of the brain that grants him humanity? And why can't he be an organ donor? The answer is, if only cerebral death would be considered death and didn't need the brainstem to be involved, then chances are we'd lose half the student body at yeshiva. The definition of death, the only definition of death, is death of the brainstem. Let me explain that statement. When the heart stops, all you kids take first aid course, life-saving courses, you do CPR. So the heart stop doesn't mean anything. You know what means something? When the heart stops long enough for the brain to die, then you can't anymore resuscitate. But until you have the damage to the brain, why can't you resuscitate? He may not awake without neurological deficit, but he'll be alive. Once the brainstem is dead, the halacha says he's dead. I'll explain that a little bit further. Next. Here you have how you diagnose brain dead. And that's the thing that disturbs me terribly. That so many people have spoken halachically on the topic of brain dead, and not one of them knows how you determine that someone is brain dead. I remember taking my father-in-law downstate. I used to call up on Friday to ask if there's any brain dead patients. I like to take my father-in-law down to see. This went on for many weeks. And one Friday, I called the fellow, an intensivist there, and I asked the same question. And he says, look, fella, you're wasting my time. He says, you just come Saturday night. They get paid on Friday. They get drunk on Saturday. They're brain dead Saturday night. And every Saturday night, we're able to see a brain dead patient.
Next slide.
Here you have.
No, maybe we'll have to get that one.
That's from an excellent text, Harrison. Harrison's textbook, which every medical student knows. It's a fabulous textbook. If you have a sefer that the pages were curled, you put this book on top of it. It is the heaviest book in any man's library. All right. There's a line there that's very important. What it says there is that it's an errorless method of diagnosing brain dead. The line is, simple test conducted at the bedside, which allows no chance of diagnostic error. And I hope some people can confirm this. To the best of my reading, Boshem, I read extensively in the field, there never has been a case of a patient diagnosed as brain dead in accord with the accepted protocol, which I'll describe, that ever, not only didn't recover, ever showed any improvement in his clinical condition. Always goes on to death. Any case where you hear he was declared brain dead, that was done by a first-year resident who had been on for 36 hours and was too darn tired to do the protocol. Next slide. This is the protocol. This protocol tells you what you do. I remember taking my father-in-law to see a brain dead patient. The one test that impressed him most was the no-gag reflex. He couldn't imagine if a man is alive, you stick something down his throat, he shouldn't gag. That he understood, that was really serious. He must be very sick if he can't respond to a gag. These tests, which check for the function of the cranial nerves going to the brain, you touch his eyeball, you pour ice water in his ear. These are classic tests to show the functioning of the nervous system. All of them are for nothing if the patient can take one breath. And therefore, the key to the test is apnea. When the patient shows no responsiveness to any stimulus I can think of, and in addition, he's not breathing, then he is dead. That's what the Gemara taught us, as we'll come to it in a minute. Now here's, people don't understand this. So it's necessary, but unfortunately, I'm involved 2 or 3 times a month in a brain dead case. And I always insist on a nucleus scan. Why? For pedagogic reasons. To convince the parents that the son has died, to convince the son that the parent has died. There's no other reason for it, because that protocol is 100% accurate, api halacha as well. But a nucleus scan, unless the person really doesn't understand anything, is so conclusive. Next slide. This is when you inject, and mind you, you don't have to touch the patient. Every patient has IVs going into him. If you stop and ask directions at a hospital, you lost someplace, you see a hospital, walk in, they won't answer you until they put an IV in. So he always has an IV. You inject a little, through the IV, you inject a little radioactive substance. Then you take a picture. It's a Geiger counter, so-called a picture of the brain. This is a normal picture. And here's a brain-dead patient, a hole in the head. Means that the radioactive substance didn't enter the brain. Now you repeat this 6 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours later, and every intelligent individual knows if I put a rubber band around my finger tight enough and leave it for 24 hours, my finger is going to die. The brain dies in 4 minutes. So by repeating the test 12 hours later, you know, unfortunately, the brain has been deprived of blood for 24 hours. You don't need much medical knowledge to understand this patient's brain is dead. Now, that is sufficient to call the patient dead, we will prove in a minute. Next slide. Here is the... if you want to see what the apnea test is. You want to check that the patient cannot breathe. So you give the patient 100% oxygen for 10 to 20 minutes. If you had that done to you, you can go underwater and stay underwater for 10, 12 minutes without difficulty. You then remove the pumping action of the ventilator, but leave a tube in that leaks oxygen, and you wait until the carbon dioxide builds up, which is necessary to stimulate the brain's breathing center. If the patient doesn't breathe after that, he's declared as having apnea. He cannot breathe on his own. No autonomic breathing. as we'll see, it doesn't mean that the fellow is yelling, screaming. It doesn't mean that his fellow is talking on the telephone. We mean he's dead, as the Gemara teaches us. Next. If you people have had your lunch already, not so terrible. Here it tells you what happens in the rare case, there aren't too many such cases nowadays, of an autopsy on a patient who's been brain dead for 4 days. And what it says, if you can read it, that pieces of the brain are found in the spinal column. The brain has softened, has liquefied. We are talking about physiological death or physiological decapitation. We're talking about also morphological decapitation, that the morphology of the brain has fallen apart. The next one. Just so you understand, death occurs in three stages, which, as we teach in our biology department, and especially this year I teach medical ethics, organismal death, organ death, and cellular death. When the brain dies, the organism no longer exists, but all his organs could be okay. I can still go ahead and take an organ out, like a kidney, and put into another patient. If I wait long enough, the organ falls apart, but individual cells within the organ are still quite alive. I can pull a cell out and show under the microscope that it's perfectly alive, but the organ has lost its organization and cannot function anymore. Finally, cellular death, when everything falls apart. Here you have the classic case, and one that disturbed Shlomo Zalman Auerbach Zatzal, which required Rav Steinberg to do that sheep decapitation experiment that I showed in my class last Wednesday. Here's a case of a woman who died brain death, but she was pregnant, and the family urged to try to keep the organs alive, which now included the fetus, until she gave birth to a live fetus. That disturbed Reb Shlomo Zalman very much, because the Gemara teaches us in Erchin, that when a woman who's pregnant dies, the baby dies first, because the fetus is weaker. And here you have a case of, we say the woman is dead, brain dead. It proves she couldn't be brain dead, because she gave birth to a live child. We'll pick this up a little bit later, too. Next.
Next slide.
See, we're up to there.
That's the decapitation experiment.
Okay. Here, what was done in order to resolve that issue. In Eretz Yisrael, they got a pregnant sheep. That was the last month of pregnancy. And they decapitated the sheep. Now, there is nobody in the world who will say that a decapitated animal or man is alive. You will see the halacha says so clearly. You have the head on one side and the sheep on the other side. They waited 45 minutes, an hour, and then by cesarean section delivered a live lamb, which I believe is still alive today. The purpose of decapitating was to remove any doubt that this animal is dead. For this is dead because God said so, he's dead. That's halacha l'moshe misinai. Hutaz rosho, if you take the head off, the person is dead, even though his heart is beating. That's the point. In the time of the guillotine, the French Revolution, they reported over and over again a man decapitated and then running. Not too long, but running. You find the, as we'll see, the Lazarus sign, right, which is for decapitated individuals, that still there'll be motion. And even, I must tell you, I'm over in a town where the Chevra Kadisha sometimes reports an hour or so after the patient was declared dead in the hospital, and they brought him to the funeral chapel, that occasionally you get a very disturbing experience of the dead person sitting up. Why? They moved the head, it still stimulated the spinal column, and got a spinal reflex which caused the patient to rise. Right. It's a major cause of heart attack among Chevra Kadisha. Right. Okay. What's the conclusion of that experiment? The conclusion of the decapitated experiment was there's no doubt that a completely decapitated animal is a dead animal. Nonetheless, all vital organs, including a fetus, can function normally in such a situation because the Gemara didn't speak about a woman on a ventilator. The Gemara spoke of a woman who died, chronic illness, accident, but wasn't put on a ventilator. Once you put on a ventilator, you now have an organ system, an organ perfusion system, where each organ can be kept alive. Let me run through here the halachic references and show you in disagreement with this Harava Goren Rav Shefter that our sources are more than adequate to answer the question whether brain death is dead without a suffix. No doubt, really. But different sources than the ones he cited. The Gemara, the Mishnah tells us, Hafochbo, Vafochbo, de Kulibar. So unfortunately, some interpret that as meaning, study the Torah, you'll find everything in the Torah. You will not find my microbiology course in the Torah. What it says is, after you study microbiology, what it tells you, what it tells you is that after you become a doctor, after you become a lawyer, then go back to the Torah, because what to do as a lawyer, what to do as a doctor, will be found in the Torah. Next. These are the halachic references. The key is the Mishnah, Hutsu Rosho, if their head is decapitated, even though they are moving Temeim, they are dead. Tumor meaning the Tumas Ohel. Kigan Zonov Shel Haltor is like the tail of a lizard that may wiggle even though after it's cut off. Next. That's the reference to the Gemara that I refer to about the Gemara saying that a pregnant woman, the fetus dies first. Again, that was a decapitation experiment. That's the Gemara in Erkin, I believe, or is that good? Whatever it is, we'll find it. I've just been noticed that if I want questions and answers, I have to speed this up. Regrettably, this requires a little bit more time. Take the next slide. And here we have that says, Kol Asher Nishma Svurim Chayim B'Yapo, the Gemara that Professor Rosner referred to, that the key is breathing. And we'll see what that means, breathing. Next. There's a Rashi. I'm sorry, they have the Rashi there. Want to back that up a bit? And that's the key.
Look at the Rashi on the bottom. Right? What Rashi says, In Doma Lemes, Sheino Mezes Evorah.
If the man looks dead because he is motionless, then we determine, is he really dead? By checking his breathing. But no one ever thought of checking the breathing when the man is moving. First he has to look dead to the layman. And then we do a test. What test? The apnea test. To see whether he's breathing or not. The key is, he's doma lemes. That answers so many of the questions.
Next. Give me the next one. We'll skip this one. Next one. All right. Here's
the Gemara that unfortunately was not cited by Rav Shechter. That's the key to our analysis. A Gemara in Chulin that says that Eli HaKohen fell off the chair. Vayihi keskiru es Aharon Elokim. When he heard that Philistines had captured the ark, Vayipol me'al hakisei achonis, he fell back from the chair, Vayomos, and he died. And the Gemara says, why did he die? Because he broke his neck. Vatishbom mafraktel. The heart was bleeding. The moment he broke his neck, he's dead. And we'll see how the halacha codifies that la halacha. Look at the next slide. Next one. Here's the Shulchan Aruch. Look at the subtitle, the caption, unbelievable caption. Mihu choshev kemes af al pi she'odeno chai. Who is considered dead even though he's alive? What does that mean? He has signs of life, motion, but he's dead al pi halacha. Why? Why is he dead? Nishbo mafraktel, the rov boser imo, a gaping wound, and he broke his neck. Comes the commentaries say, but by Eli HaKohen he didn't have any external wound. That's because you don't need decapitation to declare a person decapitated. You need physiological decapitation. And once the nerve cord was broken, even though the head seems to be still perfectly attached, he's considered to be dead. Even though the heart is beating, that's the case over there. Because of time, I need to, however, point out some critical thing. Many people cite, as did Rav Shefter in a published article, the Chacham Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi says that breathing isn't important, only heartbeat is important. Look at this quote from the Chacham Tzvi. No one ever saw the Tshuva, the Chacham Tzvi. It's 5 pages of little type. You have to wade your way through it. The Chacham Tzvi had a messed up circulatory system where he said the heart is a respiratory organ. Look what he says. You know what the heart does? What the lungs do? The function of the lungs, the breathing, is to bring cool air into the heart so the heart can breathe now with cool air and send warmer air to the rest of the body. That's the tshuva that's being cited to oppose brain dead. And everyone has cited that tshuva. No one ever stopped to read the tshuva. He had a messed up system of the circulatory system, although I think Harvey's circulatory system was already known by that time, but he didn't know it. Next. Here you have this tshuva of my father-in-law, Zatzal, that declares the key line in that tshuva is, you should know, he says, that there is a concept of autonomic breathing, and if a person is breathing only by means of the machine, harehu kemes, he is dead. Now, there's a terrible issue that arose. What did Rabbi Feinstein say? Now, so happens, I know what Rabbi Feinstein said, case after case, etc. But the question also posed a little bit of an insult to me, as if I misunderstood or misquoted my father-in-law. Nothing misquoted. This tshuva was, I told you, do you take a man off a ventilator? Nothing to do with organ transplant. And he said, the moment you've established that he's domek kemes, he's motionless, and he cannot breathe independently, then he's dead and you should remove the ventilator. This decision was opposed by the next tshuva, which is cited by everybody. Next slide. There. Here's the key line. There. This kind of breathing doesn't mean that he's alive. He's breathing only on the ventilator. Next slide. Okay. Here's the tshuva that they all cite. But Rabbi Feinstein said that a brain-dead patient is alive, not dead. And look what the tshuva says. The tshuva was written. What's that line over there? You know what it's talking about? The doctors want to say he's nechshav kemes, avsha dayin hu noshem, even though he's breathing. They're referring to cerebral death. So he rejected cerebral death because a dayin hu noshem has nothing to do with our case of brain death. Then next slide, please. Okay, this is interesting. Maybe Rav Steinberg, will you comment on that, on the Knesset bill that you were instrumental in bringing through? Okay, next. Okay, here you have plain error. Go next. Right. Hospital violates halacha in its own history. The Hamudia only last month or so, right, attacked Shaar Tzedek Hospital because of an incident where they had an organ donor, and the Hadassah cooperation somehow didn't work out, and they decided to remove the organs right then in Shaar Tzedek Hospital, which violated all their traditions. So they're attacked. But in the attack, they throw in a lie. They say that a brain-dead individual, according to Moshe Feinstein and according to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, is not considered to be a brain-dead individual, not considered to be dead. When do they wake that one up? I thought we solved that problem. This is last month we're talking about. Okay, next. And here, to my embarrassment, since Rabbi Bleich has been a main vocalist, vociferous person to attack brain death, and he said that he had a letter, was quoted from David Feinstein, my great brother-in-law, that Rabbi Feinstein didn't accept brain death. Here you have two letters. One letter here, which was delivered in 1990, and the next letter, next line, in 1993, and read the next letter, Lebiru Hadvorim, like the last lines, just to repeat, right? Imu Shochev Kemes, Vein Lo Shum Tenua, Af Shalev Poem, Mayachal Sheina Noshem, Hu Kemes Gomur, Zen Nosef Adeleel Yosef Biru. Okay? So even though he is breathing, but I'm sorry, even though his heart is beating, as long as he cannot breathe independently, he's lying like dead, meaning no motion. That's basically those criteria. I'm sorry, but I think it has to be done. Next. This is just for your information. The next one. Okay. Well, left you there. All right. Here you have the criticism of it, the decision.
Yes. The question being posed by Rabbi Bleich, that if breathing is the key, then a person with polio
who's not breathing should be considered to be dead. As I said, what's missing is he never saw the Rashi that said, Imhu doma lemes. First he has to look dead, then you check the breathing. But the fellow who has a polio, he has damage to his phrenic nerve, and he's in an iron lung, and he's breathing, and he's writing books, and I say, and he can father children. No one ever thought that breathing means an indicia of death when the other criteria are not met, namely the doma kemes.
And then you have the next. This one.
Here's a question which, unfortunately, they cite Rabban Soloveitchik here. Rabban Soloveitchik Zatzal was speaking about deep coma, nothing about brain dead.
But they bring a raya from the Rambam.
Listen to this case, because that sums up the key error that people are making. They don't know what brain dead is. The Rambam says that if a shochet shechts an animal, and then the butcher cuts open the skull, and the brain is liquefied, that proves that he was treif. Now, if brain dead is dead, and the brain is liquefied, then he wouldn't be called treif, he'd be called an avela, meaning a different level of prohibition. That's the proof they cite, that brain dead is not dead. Now, anyone stops to think, what the heck was a shochet doing in an intensive care unit that cares for cows, where he sneaked in and he shechted the animal? In order to be brain dead, you have to have apnea. You cannot breathe. So a shochet walks in, an animal is lying on the ground, and he's on a ventilator, and he goes over and he shechts him. What is into the mind to cite such a Rambam? What's the case? That's the case of Nikav Krum Shel Moach. There was animals like attacked by a wolf, and there's a damage to the meninge, and he's leaking spinal fluid. That's the word Moach, does mean brain in the Gemara. It means marrow, or brain, or spinal fluid. So they go ahead and they cite this. With what kind of responsibility? And then comes the next. Here's where a number of signatories, including Rav Schefter and Rav Willig, went ahead and they distributed to the RCA, Reform Council of America, in opposition to the stand that the RCA has taken to support brain death. And they put in that what? And I read that over there, that I read if you out loud, a careful reading of the published materials reveals that the term brain death was never mentioned in the original decision of the Rabbonut HaRoshit, of the chief rabbinate. They never saw the decision. That's the next. Okay? Take the next one. It makes up, I made an error there. I'm sorry, next slide. Okay, here's the tshuva, the original tshuva of the Rabbonut HaRoshit. Here's page one. Next, page two. Page three, what's on top of the page? Misas, what's on top, and that on top of the page? Krias Mobes Mochi, how do you establish brain dead? What's the next stage? Next, something which is really difficult to understand. After what we heard Rav Shechter say, that our Rabbi Shapiro told him that brain dead is only due to a traffic accident. And over there, and the last first page is how you define brain death, what tests you have to do. And the next page is what tells you on the following page is the when do you decide that a person is brain dead? It requires the following: chabola mochis kosher, which means trauma. Next, dimum toch mor kosher, means a stroke, right, a bleeding stroke. Nezek mochi anaxi, means lack of oxygen. Every single case that leads to brain death was covered in the tshuva. Not just a case of traffic, which wouldn't make any sense. Now, Rav Shapta heard that from Rav Shapiro. What Rav Phil had in mind, I haven't the slightest idea. We'll finish off with what is a dramatic entry. Yeah, I'll tell you what it says here. Many people go for Pesach to what was the Granite Hotel. Granite Hotel is run by a member of my shul, Barry Hachdorf. Barry Hachdorf, his great yichus is, he was one of the five students in the first class I taught in microbiology at Yeshiva College. Barry Hachdorf, who is a tough fellow, doesn't stand for any nonsense, went to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in December 30th, 1992, went with his son-in-law and asked Shlomo Zalman a simple question. I'm a dentist, he says, but I'm involved in medical decisions. You must tell me, a person is brainstem dead according to Rabbi Tendler. Can we take out his organs? And the answer was an affirmative. In America, you can do so. That's what the reader is. And maybe Steinberg will be able to explain that a little bit. I have, from Shlomo Zalman, a handwritten letter saying, in America, brainstem death is okay. Why in America? I must say, because he had little confidence in the doctors in Israel and was afraid that they would, afraid of the slippery slope, that if you allow this there. But this was a clear, despite the yes and no, the Rafi Biyodeh, that he was seemed to be uncertain in many of his answers. Here's a final answer where he gave it clear. That, under the time pressure, is the best we can do. I hope I've clarified the issue, and I hope, Emir Sashem, that Rav Shachter and Rav Willig, in reviewing this, will concur that brainstem death is the only halachic definition of death.
We just have a few moments, maybe for a question or two, if anybody has a question for Rabbi Tendler. Would Rav be able to take questions?
Yeah.
Anybody, any questions? The rest of the program and get to finish by 6:15. Thank you. Rav Tendler. Coming out of this colloquium, I'm a little confused because basically presented to us, we had Rav Shechter's opinion and then Rav Tendler's opinion. Rav Shechter didn't really have a chance to do a rebuttal, I was wondering how should we basically decide, like...
Speak louder. So his question is, because we just heard Rav Schechter, who gave his position. We heard Rav Tendler, who gave the Rav's position. How do we decide between the two?
Very simple. Wait a week or so till Rav Schechter hears what I said. He'll change his mind.
Yeah, we have time for one more question. Any questions?
If is a Kohen permitted to get a deceased donor organ? Or another example is, in the time of Beis HaMikdash, when we have the laws of Tameh and Tahor, of Tahara, are you permitted to get an deceased organ?
So the question was about in the times of the Beis HaMikdash in terms of Tumah v'Tahara. Are you talking about whether a
right,
Kohen?
Right, if you get, or even today, and in terms of a Kohen, if you get an organ from a deceased donor, is that an issue?
If can a Kohen receive an organ from a deceased donor, is that an issue of violating the laws of Tumah v'Tahara?
Rabbi Feinstein has a tshuva on that. He says that once the organ is attached and the organ, quote, is alive, then it didn't come from a dead person. A dead person is when everything is dead. But if you can go ahead and do Trias HaMesim and resuscitate a person, he wouldn't be dead. You can resuscitate an organ, and the organ then has the definition of life.
Thank you very much. I also, for a wonderful presentation by Rabbi Tendler, never disappoints. We'll begin our session in 1 minute. I also want to acknowledge the presence of our Chancellor, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who has graced us with his presence here for this wonderful conference. Our next session will begin right now. You want to speak first? Okay. Before our next session... Just a few words from our Dean of the Center for the Jewish Future.
Again, I'm not going to use that. Again, I would just want to...